Welcome to Who Killed Donald T. Johnson, a progressive murder mystery podcast. This episode, Best Served Cold, by Steve Haynes.
Men like Jeffrey Epstein, James Packer, and Murdoch have suffered recently through the eyes of the media. Of course, this is not new. Here in Australia, we have seen former business giants like Christopher Skase and Alan Bond stripped of their reputation. And words like corrupt and villain are now attached to them forever. But can you imagine what sort of person could be created out of an amalgamation of all of them? We have. And his name is Donald T. Johnson. Not surprisingly, a great many people want to kill him. This is just one of them.
There are not many people who can claim to go from being a juvenile delinquent with a prison sentence to a hero awarded Australia's highest honour, then to a villain owing debts of $1.8 million, back in jail for 4 years, then rise to be a major businessman before dying once more in debt. Alan Bond, born 1938, did just that, and along the way, he had a colourful life, taking hundreds of innocent investors into their own bankruptcies. He will forever be known as the main player in the 1983 America's Cup, winning the championship after 132 years with his famed winged keel yacht, Australia 2. Or maybe it was for his 1987 purchase of Vincent van Gogh's painting, The Irises, for which he paid a staggering $54 million. An extravagant gesture, especially as it was funded by a substantial loan by Sotheby's, which he failed to pay. A manipulated sale designed to artificially inflate the painting's value. This is a well-recognized ploy of businessmen, sometimes known as a Ponzi scheme, a scheme that businessmen can initiate as a combined force, a sort of birds of a feather flock together principle, and a well-known strategy of businessman Donald T. Johnson, who gained his billions at the price of small-time investors, hoping to share some of his Midas touch. It is May 20th, 2018. The streets are still crowded with partygoers who will find any excuse for a party, but no excuse needed for a royal wedding. They will soon go home with headaches and hangovers. But right now, a mother and son have another reason for worry. They are being escorted by police into a special room in London, and what transpires will link them with the royal day far more than any partygoer.
The door to the interview room opened, and a solidly built man in a tuxedo was escorted in and firmly sat down in a chair. The man showed no emotion as he put his handcuffed hands on the table. Even to the uninformed observer, these heavy-duty restraints weren't the kind issued to police. An older woman was shown in and shown to a chair to the left-hand side of the man. Like the man, she was also handcuffed, although her restraints weren't quite as formidable. Neither of them spoke, and only the woman looked when the interrogator, a slim woman in a black suit and tie, entered the room.
Good evening, Major Blackwell. Mrs. Blackwell. Not often we get a mother-son team in here.
Why are we here?
Frankly, you, Major. You are located at the scene of the murder of Donald T. Johnson, and of course, Plod being Plod, takes your name and runs checks. Naturally, when one of Her Majesty's Colonial Special Forces troopers visits, you're flagged at the border. But when your name came up in a murder inquiry, it generated a please render assistance flag from Australian intelligence.
The interrogator looked to Blackwell, but he sat silently.
Major Thomas Blackwell, Australian Special Air Service. Current duty.
The interrogator looked at her iPad device and scrolled.
Ah, there it is. Quote, seconded to special duties, end quote. Now, our checks didn't indicate what those special duties are, but given the nature of the flagged request, who it was from, and the fact you were at a murder scene, well, we thought it best to help. Even if just to sort out what is going on. It upset Plod no end. Still, our law enforcement liaison officer will sort all that out.
There were about 200 people at that party. Are we suspected of something?
The interrogator's eyes remained on Major Blackwell, watching to see if his mother's outburst would elicit a reaction, but his face and body language remained unchanged. The interrogator turned slightly to face Mrs. Blackwell.
Not yet. Officially, the police are saying they're pursuing various lines of inquiry with persons of interest. Which is the old Bill saying, they know they've got a villain, they're just not sure which one.
So, no?
No, not yet. However, given your son's skill set, I'm inclined to be suspicious and cautious, hence the handcuffs. Now, obviously, you're going to say that you were at the event because you were invited.
The pair remained silent, and the interrogator opened a folio box that she had placed on the table and took out evidence bags.
Two mobile telephones. Men's wallet with cash and cards. Clutch purse, also with cash, cards. Metal cigarette case and lighter. Two security vetted tickets to the event tonight. Since you were guests of His Royal Highness's wedding this week, you're both on the A-list for a lot of events. But what I want to know is, what specifically brought you to this event?
Before either Blackwell could answer, the interrogator held up one hand for silence and touched the device at her ear.
Yes. Yes. I understand. Seems you have a secure incoming call, Major. I'll put it on the screen.
The interrogator's fingers ran over the iPad, and the TV screen attached to the wall of the video room came on to reveal an older man sitting in a darkened room.
Good evening, Mr.
Give us the room, please, interrogator. You'll be fully briefed once you're outside.
A look of annoyance at being so casually dismissed by this unknown Australian flashed over the interrogator's face, but she regained her composure and left the room.
Colonel.
Shut up, Blackwell. What the fuck have you gotten yourself into? You were given permission to attend the royal wedding, the odd social event, and then straight back home. Now I'm getting notified that MI6 had to pick you up from a murder scene. You know I hate being in debt to those pommy bastards.
Yes, sir.
I've been briefed by my opposite at MI6 that grubby little prick Johnson has gone and got himself murdered. And you, one of Australia's premier assassins, is found at the crime scene.
Blackwell opened his mouth to speak.
Don't bother with whatever nonsense you're going to try and trot out to me. I don't believe in coincidence, Blackwell. If you're there, you're involved somehow. Luckily for you, there are two things in your favour.
Blackwell shut his mouth and sat silently listening to hear what the Colonel had to say.
Firstly, even though a dozen law enforcement agencies were ready to throw a net over him and are mightily pissed that he's now dead, nearly the same number of intelligence agencies, and more importantly, their political masters, appreciate that his death, rather than arrest and subsequent testimony, solves a lot of problems. That group includes MI6. Secondly, it seems that there are other people at the same event who not only wanted him dead, but may have been involved in the killing. Long story short, whatever your involvement in this matter is, I may be able to avoid it coming out. Officially.
I sense there is a but here, sir.
Blackwell, our job often resolves around deception and lies, even with allies. But sometimes, and rest assured this is one of those occasions, your only way forward is honesty. The Brits want to know the truth. That way, they can control the spin on what will be the official story. But they need the truth. In fact, they're demanding it. If you lie, they'll hang you out to dry, ally or not. In fact, you're the perfect fall guy. Highly trained military man with a family history to the deceased. Next thing you know, you'll be a PTSD veteran bent on revenge, and, of course, suicide in custody will follow. Then there's your mother to think of.
The Colonel paused for a second, realising his bad manners.
Oh, pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Blackwell. You need to be on board for this as well. I'm not exaggerating about what will happen if they like Thomas for this, or what might happen to you. I don't have any guarantees, but it has been made very clear that only absolute honesty about your involvement in this matter will result in their cooperation.
I understand, sir.
Blackwell looked at his mother, and a sense of understanding passed between them, ending with both of them nodding.
The truth.
Very good, Blackwell. If you do make it back, you know I'm going to kick your ass personally. Anyway, good luck and Godspeed. If you don't make it through, goodbye.
The video screen went black, and shortly after, the interrogator returned to the room.
I am led to understand you wish to tell me what happened tonight.
Tonight? Tonight started decades ago. If you want the story, you should get comfortable. Speaking of which, would you mind taking the handcuffs off of my mother, please?
Of course.
The interrogator leaned across the table and unlocked the handcuffs. They clunked down on the table in front of him.
Well, let's start at the beginning.
If we're going to start at the beginning, then you should begin by talking to me. But first I need a cigarette. Slide them over, please.
Sorry, no smoking is allowed.
Piss off. You're telling me that Workplace Health and Safety are going to do a snap audit of an MI6 interrogation cell? Slide the bloody ciggies over. Let's get it over and done with.
I was born in England and became a model after leaving school. I was 20 years old and doing all right. And then in 1980, I got a junket for a photo shoot in Perth, Australia. They were launching a chain of English pubs. Perth is full of English expats. The client showed us the highlights, and one night I met this cocky young bloke from the bush who was trying to crack into the Perth real estate world. It was, well, if not love at first sight, certainly meaningful lust.
Is this trip down memory lane totally relevant?
Well, we were told you demanded the truth. Well, the truth is found in history. Now shush. Well, one thing led to another, and that real estate bloke became my husband. Nick Jacks. Knick-knack to his mates. And Lord, did he have some mates back in those days. I kept up the modelling, but saw the writing on the wall. The real money was in management. I started my own modelling agency, small, but it grew. Nick, he just went from strength to strength. You have to understand that Perth in the 80s was on the move. Alan Bond, he was tearing the town up with his wheeling and dealing. Nick and Bondy got on like a house on fire, and Nick went from strength to strength with Bondy. Lang Hancock was making it big with his iron ore mining, and a young Twiggy Forrest was already making a name for himself in the stock market. It was a whirlwind back then. Business deals and long lunches, champers, coke, sex and endless parties with all of Perth's beautiful people. Between Nick's growing real estate business, his connections with Bondi and, of course, my blossoming model agency, we went to all the best parties, often with a dozen beautiful young models, men and women, all in our entourage.
You were a pimp, then?
Watch it. These handcuffs won't stop me from snapping your neck.
It's okay, Thomas. I didn't catch your name, and frankly, I don't care to. Everyone was adults back then. Everyone was trying to get noticed to become rich and famous. My models came with us because those parties were an opportunity. Networking, a chance to make it big. You're a civil servant with your grey little view of the world. You probably don't understand. But no, I wasn't a pimp.
The interrogator nervously adjusted her already perfectly tied tie, avoiding eye contact with Major Blackwell.
My misunderstanding. Go on.
By the time Bondi won the America's Cup in 1983, we'd already made our first million, and we were well on our way to many more. We didn't go to the States to see the big race, but when Bondi got back, we were amongst the first people he saw. And that was the first time I heard the name Donald T. Johnson. Bondi had met him during the America's Cup, and they became thick as thieves. Bondi was a lovable rogue, but a crook at heart. And like attracts like. Bondi and the Royal Perth Yacht Club had to defend the cup in 87, and Perth was crazy. The world was on our doorstep. Every day was just one long party. Bondi was in his element, and Nick and I were now in the inner circle. We had our own yacht by then, and of course Thomas had come along in 85. I thought life couldn't get any better. And into all this blew Johnson, big, brassy and bold, as only the 80s could produce. For all his sins, I never really had a bad word to say against Bondi. Except he introduced Nick to him. Bondi had been dodgy, but you knew that. Everyone was a little dodgy back then. But Johnson, he was a different kettle of fish.
To say the least, he was already suspected of dozens of crimes back then, race-fixing in the sailing world being the least of them.
And already getting a leave pass for his activities from various governments. I understand while he was in Perth in 87, he helped relocate some of your government's Northern Ireland problem children.
No comment. Is that going to become a negotiation issue over this incident, Major?
No, just a bit more of the truth in history, as Mum put it. I think I'll take a smoke as well. Slide them over, would you please, Mum?
Johnson hung around Perth for a while, real estate dealing, and of course, other business.
The Major drew back on the cigarette and let out the smoke.
Johnson hooked up with Nick. In the beginning, it was all legitimate deals. Waterfront properties, business properties, all above board and quite profitable. Initially, Johnson and I even got on all right. He was a bit handsy, but all those blokes were back then. Usually a sharp hand slap would get the message across. But Johnson always thought himself God's gift.
More the devil's own bastard.
The first falling out we had with him was over some of my girls. I said before that everyone was consenting adults back then, and I was strict with my models. If you weren't old enough to vote, you couldn't party with us. Word filtered back to me that Johnson was trying to go through some of the women who came with us. To get introductions to my younger models.
Mrs. Blackwell looked around.
Do you have something here I can use as an ashtray?
The interrogator nodded to the guard standing behind Mrs. Blackwell, and they left the room. Returning with a battered old teacup.
Eventually the stories I was getting told were getting worse. And I wasn't going to cop that. So I fronted Johnson one day at a party. You should have seen the look he gave me. Called the girls liars, of course. I told him straight to his face I didn't care, and he had to stay away from my girls. He stormed off. I thought it might come back to bite Nick, but nothing further was said. Of course, I didn't realise until years later that the vindictive prick decided to stitch us up in a much longer play.
You weren't to know, Mum.
No, no one saw it, not even your dad, and he had a great nose for bullshit artists. Sadly, with the new decade, he'd also started to get a great nose for coke. It was a lifestyle back then. Everyone was doing it. The only problem was, the more successful he became, the hours became longer, and the drugs helped him push through. It's a vicious circle, and the more you take, the more you need.
Mrs. Blackwell turned to the Major.
It blurred your dad's judgment, Tom. He got deeper and deeper with Johnson. I mean, the deals and the money were fantastic, on paper at least. Can you pass the ciggies back, please? Though I'm one to talk about addiction, I'm still sucking on these damn things. Of course, it all came to a head with the crash in 1990. The market dropped out, and when the dust cleared, the paper profits not only disappeared, but it turns out they only ever existed on paper. Johnson, of course, covered his tracks and was gone, leaving Nick to carry the bag. He was a victim of Johnson as much as anyone else. More so because he looked like he'd been actively involved. He blamed himself for not seeing it, but, well, someone had to pay.
Mrs. Blackwell drew in a long breath, holding back from crying at the memories. She spun to face the interrogator and jabbed her finger viciously in her direction.
You know what that bastard did? He rang me one night. Nick was in custody, a flight risk, they said. I'd picked the phone up thinking something had happened to him, but there was nobody. Then I heard this sleazy deep breathing down the line. I didn't recognise it and demanded to know who it was. His message was simple, though. Maybe if I reconsidered my policy on the younger models, things could go differently for Nick. Tom, I was so tempted. Your dad was everything to me. I swear I would have given in to that bastard. But down the phone line, I heard him laugh. I knew then he wouldn't help your dad. He just wanted to hear me debase myself. I just told him to fuck off. I slammed the phone down.
It's okay, Mum. You did the right thing. And that bastard is in hell now.
Well, the morgue, at least. Perhaps we should move more towards that point.
You can't rush the truth, mate.
The Major reached awkwardly up to his pocket and removed a handkerchief and passed it to his mother, and she wiped her eyes.
Thank you, Tom. My husband eventually went to trial in 92 and lost. Johnson had done a great job on him. Nick always felt partially responsible. He'd failed to protect his investors, his family. At heart, he was resigned to going to jail. He even filed for divorce while he was in prison. I objected, but he wanted Tom and me to try and distance ourselves from the scandal. He thought changing back to my maiden name would help Tom and I step away from it all. He forgot how small Perth was back then.
In a sense, this is where I enter the story of tonight. Mum managed to hang on to her business. Despite it all, we still had some friends. She kept me in private school, which meant I got a great education. An education supplemented by focused bullying from the snot-nosed brats of other business types. The parents had worked cheek by jowl with Dad and Johnson. I suspect they were probably guilty of actual crimes. But they didn't have a Donald T. Johnson gunning for them. I got an education. I learned to hate Johnson more with every passing year. They didn't even let up on me when Dad died.
Murdered. He was murdered. Nick accepted the fact he was responsible for letting this happen, and he was going to do his time. He got 7 years. He was using that time to pore over the court documents, taxation records, everything he could get his hands on. His cell was full of document boxes. He spent every free minute going over them, trying to prove that Johnson was behind it all. It took him over a year. It was Easter of 1994. He rang me from prison and told me he'd found proof. He didn't want to talk about it on the phone as the calls were recorded and he didn't know who he could trust. He was going to show me when I next visited and get me to take it to the lawyers. Turns out, though, he couldn't trust anyone. Even the little bit he let slip on the phone was enough. The day before I was set to visit him, someone threw a prison-made firebomb into his cell. It wasn't big, but they pulled the door shut on him, and with all those boxes of documents.
Mrs. Blackwell broke down again. She held her son's handkerchief to hide her tears.
We buried Dad on a beautiful Perth day, shining sun and gentle breeze off the ocean. You always expect it to rain at funerals. Life was tough. Mum was working long hours trying to rebuild her business, our family reputation. And even though I was just a child, I knew it was just Mum and me against the world. I helped as much as possible, learning to do things around the house. At school, even then at that young age, I was driven to push myself. Academically, sports, I just threw myself into it. I had to prove to everyone that, well, I just had to prove myself better than them.
People might judge me, say I was a bad mother, but Thomas and I always had that understanding. Like he said, it was us against the world. And I told him the truth about the world. The brutal truth. Johnson, his father's betrayal, and the murder.
Somewhere, I don't think either one of us could point to a specific date, we decided that, given the opportunity, we'd kill Donald T. Johnson. We'd sit and fantasize all the fanciful ways we'd kill him if we had the chance. Probably not healthy, but we all deal with grief in our own ways.
The interrogator's eyes had been going from mother to son, following the conversation with more than just professional interest by now. Suddenly, she jumped ever so slightly and again raised her hand for silence, while using her other hand to activate her earpiece.
Yes. I see. I'll tell him. That was our law enforcement liaison officer. The police want your fingerprints.
That's no problem.
They won't find your prints at the scene, will they?
No.
And a murder weapon?
Major Blackwell paused before answering.
If they find it, they won't recognize it as the murder weapon, unless someone pushes them in the right direction.
No comment, for now. Continue, please.
My rugby coach at school also pushed me in the direction of army cadets, eventually suggesting a career in the army. And I'd be lying if part of me didn't see that as a way of getting a skill set for our revenge. I did officer training and ended up in an armored mech unit. That's how I met Harry. I mean, His Highness. I was in Afghan in 07, and my unit did a stint in a joint op with his. We were both young officers, both had lost a parent, loved rugby. We just hit it off.
I couldn't believe it when he sent home a picture of him with the prince. I was sworn to secrecy, of course.
We stayed in touch even after I made it into the SAS.
Suddenly, especially after I realized that my ideas with an IED, Johnson were now changing to the possibility of killing him and getting away with it.
We went to Invictus.
I mean, the government was teaching me how to do it when Harry came over to me.
Made to measure accident.
Called me Black.
How to stage someone being lost at sea. Overdose of illegal
heartwarming story,
or
I'm
legal
sure.
Drugs.
Although I guess it explains how you got the invite
stroke,
to the wedding.
Diabetic
yes.
Reaction.
I didn't
heart
plan
attack.
It, but
pick your
we took advantage of it when Mum and I realized it would get us back into the same social circles as Johnson. It was just another piece of fate falling into place for our revenge. My military career was an extension of my childhood need to be better, but also my childhood desire to become deadly enough that if I ever got the chance to get close to that bastard Johnson again, I'd kill him.
And is that what happened tonight?
I bet you're one of those people who just turns to the last page of a mystery novel. Given what the stakes are here, I want to make sure the whole story comes out. So, I did well in special forces. Even by the unconventional warfare we practiced, I gravitated towards ever more exotic missions. Add to that a knack for languages, I eventually got tapped on the shoulder to this line of work. It was a whole new world of skills, techniques, weapons, well, you know. Suddenly, I started to realize that my ideas about killing Johnson were now changing to the possibility of killing him and getting away with it. I mean, the government was teaching me how to do it. Made-to-measure accident. How to stage someone being lost at sea. Overdose of illegal or legal drugs. And of course, how to cause a stroke, diabetic reaction, heart attack. Pick your poison. Literally.
You said that you and your mother often fantasized about killing Johnson. Did that fantasy now become premeditation?
The Blackwells looked at each other, and an understanding passed between them.
Yes. I was sworn to secrecy about my job, and I never broke that, even for Mum. But she was clever enough to never ask me how I knew all these things. So, during the times I was able to get home in between jobs, I'd go back to Perth and we'd talk over different scenarios. The options that could see us getting our revenge.
Not that I saw him often. It was bad enough when he was in the army. Given his transient lifestyle, I remained his constant point of contact for all his old friends. As his mum, I got sad at seeing all the invites to engagements and weddings and baby showers. I'd email in the details, and eventually I'd get an email back asking if I could reply back his regret.
That all changed when I got the invitation. Mum emailed me immediately, and as luck would have it, I was in Australia, debriefing from my last job. I was able to bring it up with my superiors and make a formal request to attend. I hadn't taken any real leave since I left the SAS, and given the unique nature of the event, the colonel signed off on my leave. It was months away, so I had to keep working, but they swung it so that I could remain in Australia. Luckily, even in our line of work, there are still mandatory courses to attend and reports to be caught up on.
The interrogator half smiled and nodded in agreement.
He even managed to make it home on a couple of weekends. That's where we really started our planning. As soon as Thomas had accepted the invitation, he started getting invites for all the surrounding social events. Garden party at the palace, the Invictus community, Australia House, even Elton John. Finally, the one we were waiting on. Johnson himself was holding a gala event at his London hotel.
Turns out Dad's idea for Mum and me to change our name paid off. Not in the way he envisaged, but nonetheless it paid off. Johnson only knew Mum by her married name of Jax. Inviting Major Blackwell and a guest would mean nothing to him, if he even saw the list, of course.
So, you accepted the invite. Out of interest, did you accept Sir Elton's?
Of course. Revenge is one thing, but his parties are the stuff of legend.
Plus, we needed to play the part. We accepted a couple invites, the Palace Garden Party, of course, and Invictus. We wanted to give the impression we were there to celebrate and socialise, just like everyone else.
Naturally. You accepted the invite, then what?
We realised this was our opportunity, not just to kill him, but to do what he did. Get away with it. Although, that's yet to be established.
Major Blackwell lifted his restrained hands and looked at the interrogator, who kept her face neutral.
We also realised we wanted him to know. To know it was us. That it was for Dad. So we started to plan, and tonight we executed the plan. We had already booked into the hotel for our stay. Gave us plenty of time to check out the layout of the function room for the party. Mum came into her own there.
Thomas may be the spy in the family, but I've spent my life moving amongst these types of events. Perth may be a long way from London, but you'd be surprised how similar things are worldwide. And of course, when you casually drop that you're in town for the royal wedding, you'd be amazed how much people want to talk to you and be your friend.
Mum put some surveillance teams I've known to shame. I had her wired up with some covert gear, so between the visuals and her networking with staff and guests, we knew the layout. The schedule, even where the staff went to scoff down uneaten food or guests would go to consume slightly more illicit substances.
Thomas had run through how the CCTV cameras worked and where the blind spots would be in the room. And we worked out the areas where we needed to get Johnson alone to confront him. Thomas and I entered the party and split up. We'd already practiced some subtle signals so we knew which way we were moving or when we would act.
Why not use mic and earpieces? You could easily access them, Major.
Just another layer of security. We had planned for the death to look non-suspicious, but if it went wrong, I knew police would be all over the CCTV. And a couple who were constantly shadowing Johnson, and no matter how careful you are, you can't totally conceal the use of comms. Once they saw that, they'd get in forensic lip readers to see what we were saying to each other, and that would be that.
That was half the problem. We had to find a spot where I could speak to him and not get recorded. But we had waited this long. We could be patient. Anyway, parties are like the ocean. They have tides that ebb and flow. People get pushed around like so much flotsam. Eventually, Johnson was between clicks and walking through a blind spot. I signaled Thomas and moved in, flashed him my warmest smile. He stopped, still believing he was God's gift to women. I enjoyed watching his fat, smug face drain of its sleazy confidence as he realised who I was. I simply said, "You killed my husband," and signalled Thomas.
We had done research on Johnson over the years. We knew he suffered a back injury playing polo. It famously left him with a recurring back pain on his left side. I drew out my weapon, walked up to him, and bumped into his left side. He would naturally assume the flash of pain he experienced was his old injury.
Your weapon was what, exactly?
I used a hotel pen. Took the insides out and placed in a custom-built pressure syringe system. Pushed it into his back. It delivered a measured dosage of a genetically modified toxin that would induce a heart attack. He felt it, and turned around in pain, but I had already melted into the crowd.
He turned back to me. I could see it had hurt him. That made me smile. He was confused, and I said to him, "And now my son has killed you." And I walked off into the crowd.
The toxin's modifications mean it takes about 15 minutes to work, but once it kicks in, it takes only 5 minutes. The toxin breaks down quickly, and it's only used by my section, and until tonight, never used outside of Southeast Asia. It's highly unlikely a pathologist will detect it, even if they could get him under the knife before it broke down completely.
Major Blackwell looked at the clock on the wall of the interrogation room.
And if he isn't being autopsied by now, they've missed their chance.
Weren't you worried he'd tell someone?
Tell them what? A madwoman talking about the death of her husband 30 years ago, or that her son had killed him. And from his point of view, it was crazy talk. He wasn't dead by the hand of some mysterious son. The only thing that happened to him was some drunk had knocked his sore back.
Where is the weapon now?
I walked into the toilets, dropped the mechanism out of the pen, crushed it under my heel, and flushed the broken parts with peeled-off latex film covering my prints. Then I dumped the empty pen into a rubbish bin in the ballroom, with 200 guests eating and drinking. They'd empty them regularly.
I found the nearest waiter and took a drink to stand back and watch him die. But then he left with those other people, and I couldn't follow without drawing attention to myself. What happened after that, I don't know.
I had re-entered the room, having gotten rid of the evidence, and joined Mum. She told me that Johnson had left, but I wasn't worried. That toxin is always fatal. It took years, but we got justice for my father. We got our revenge.
It's best served cold, they say.
The interrogator tapped on her iPad and touched her earpiece, but said nothing.
Now you have the whole story. Are we guilty?
It has been reported that the controversial billionaire Donald T. Johnson has died. He was rushed to Great Ormond Street Hospital late yesterday evening, but died shortly after admittance. His physician, Dr. Leslie Price, said it appeared to be heart failure.
You have been listening to Best Served Cold, script by Steve Haynes. Produced by Brianda Cross. Performed by presenter Toby Chittenden, narrator James Cridland, interrogator Sally Walker, Major Blackwell, Geordie MacDonald, Mrs. Blackwell, Jen Haynes, and Patrick O'Callaghan as the Colonel. For earlier episodes, backstory, and links, please go to progressivemurdermysterypodcasts.com. And look out for the next episode, Bullseye by J.C. Leslie. And if you have the time, please give us a review on your favourite podcast platform. Until next time, thank you.